the more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Julianne Schwartz, along with Noah Bristol and Michelle Coppola. Together, we bring you a monthly program dedicated to giving a voice to the urgent animal welfare and animal rights issues happening locally, regionally, and worldwide. You can listen to Voices for the Animals on the fourth Friday of every month at 10 a.m. You can also listen at kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals or find us on Google Play and iTunes. I am pleased to introduce Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth, on Facebook and Instagram. Elizabeth is an animal rights activist, rescuer, marine biologist, and conservationist. Elizabeth left her day job as a marine biologist to pursue animal rescue and full-time activism. She travels domestically and internationally to document animal rights and environmental issues, as well as educate the public about impacts of animal agriculture. She also runs a nonprofit animal rescue and volunteers with the Wildlife Rehabilitation and Rescue Center. Welcome, Liz.
Hi there. How are you guys?
We're good. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I just want to say I was incredibly impressed on all of the things that you're active in when I was doing my research on you. It's amazing everything that you do. I don't know how you find time for it.
Oh, thank you very much. That means a lot. I appreciate that.
So let's go ahead and get started. I just wanted to find out how you got started in disaster relief and animal activism.
Sure. So in 2017, I was involved in a scaled down version of storm prep and rescue during Hurricane Irma that passed through Florida and wreaked damage in the Florida Keys. And prior to the storm making landfall, I had assisted the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center where I work and volunteer, Pelican Harbor Seabird Station. Basically in preparation for transporting all the animals to secure locations and battening down the hatches. My partner and I were also instrumental in assisting local givers and community members in getting animals to safety. And during the storm, we actually went out, it's not advised, but during the storm itself and took in some cats and a duck. And post-disaster, I really got a glimpse at what these storms can do to local communities, the environment, and the non-humans, as well as humans that are affected by them. So it really sparked a motivation in me to get more involved. Following that, I was contacted by a film production company about a year later, Condition One. They're an immersive film production company that focuses on virtual reality experiences that document important issues like climate change and the ethical concerns and environmental impacts of the animal agricultural industries. I joined them for a week in North Carolina during Hurricane Florence, which caused record-breaking flooding throughout. And while we were there, we were able to rescue many different animals, as well as documenting some of these impacts on the farmed animals that we don't really see as much in the media. But a lot of these places, I'm sure you're all familiar with, industrial factory farming, there could be as many as 30,000 birds in each one of these quote-unquote farms, also known as sheds. And so throughout the state alone, it was reported that between 3.4 million chickens and turkeys and approximately 5,500 pigs died. So we were also getting a first-hand glimpse at that as well and trying to document that to the best of our abilities so that we could really show the loss of life as well as the environmental impacts of these storms. And there's so many potential contamination risks with things like that. And that kind of sparked another aspect of me wanting to get more involved in the environmental side of that and the cleanup. But seeing these things firsthand definitely motivated me to get more involved. And I've been involved in a couple different disasters since then.
Yeah, you were recently in the Bahamas for disaster relief with the most recent hurricanes. What did you see when you were there?
Yes. So that was very heartbreaking to witness. I was there from about a week post-disaster and about a month and a half following doing week-long or weekend-long trips to and from. It was extremely devastating, both on a infrastructure damage as well as loss of life scale. It was something that I had never seen to that degree before. There's a reported 60-something confirmed deaths, but there's likely over 2,000 to 2,500 people who perished during that storm. So just the actual scale of that and seeing it was unlike anything I'd ever witnessed before. It was an unrecognizable island in Abaco, where I spent most of my time there. You know, in these areas, these small island developing communities, they don't have the infrastructure or the resources that places that might have that in Florida or other more developed regions. So the casualties as well as just the absolute damage that occurred there was unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
I know a lot of people perished during that hurricane. As far as animals go, did you see a lot of the same things that you were seeing in North Carolina?
There were not the farms that we saw in North Carolina. For example, in North Carolina, they are the number two supplier, producer of pig products. So in terms of scale of farmed animals, we didn't see that. But in terms of cats and dogs, absolutely, to a greater degree, actually. I think we ended up rescuing over a couple hundred animals during our time there, and they're still doing relief efforts and rescue there on the ground as well. But there, the issue is more that there's a lot of feral or stray animals that have not been sterilized. So once the storm hit, they kind of just ran and tried to seek cover. So trying to catch a lot of them who had been injured and needed vet care, as well as in the future providing them with those sterilization and additional surgeries. That's something that we didn't see in North Carolina. That was definitely different.
When you're doing the disaster relief in North Carolina and you're rescuing these animals in the Bahamas, where are these animals going after they find shelter and rescue with you?
That's a great question. So it really depends on the situation. So in North Carolina, we had a great group of rescuers from a couple different organizations. When we were there, we were partnered with Brother Wolf Animal Rescue that's based out of Asheville. And they were instrumental in quarantining and transporting all of the animals that we would catch throughout the day. And essentially what happens is you obviously provide like what is known as triaging them, initially checking for any severe lacerations or any, you know, huge red flags in terms of health concerns, and then getting them food, water, and then you're going to transport them to somewhere where they'll be held for a certain number of days. And then their human family can either claim them. If nobody comes forward, then they're eventually transported to Brother Wolf or another partner organization where they then can be adopted through a proper vetting process of the potential adopter. Whereas in the Bahamas, it was a bit different, where every day we were going out from dawn to dusk and later into the evening, catching a lot of these animals. And then we were actually, we built basically a temporary shelter in a partly destroyed house, an abandoned structure. And the following day, we had another rescue there, BARC, a local organization that was sending over small chartered planes. And we were actually sending these dogs and cats and even some bunnies, anybody that we would find. And we were sending them to Nassau, one of the unaffected areas, islands. And there they were performing all the triage and getting them those services that they required. And then they held on to them for at least 30 days so that people affected by the disaster could come forward and claim their companions.
It's really amazing that they offered to let those animals stay there while people were getting on their feet and trying to find their companions.
Absolutely. And it was really amazing seeing some of the reunification. These people lost everything in these storms, family members, any personal possessions that they had, and to see them with just these huge smiles and tears running down their face being reunified with, you know, their non-human family members was really, it really made everything worth it and just was great to see.
You have your own kitten rescue. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So I am in the process of getting my 501c3. I do a lot of kitten rescue just because I've historically always lived in a one-bedroom apartment. I just moved to a little bit bigger place, but I do focus on cats and kittens. But I do help a lot of transport with farmed animals, and I've been known to take in the occasional wild animal. But yes, I am really excited to legitimize a nonprofit In the past, I was working a lot with partner organizations and doing a lot of self-funding. But now that I'll be able to do that, it'll give me more opportunities to get grants and do some more exciting projects.
That's very exciting, Liz. I know earlier you were speaking about Condition One and your new docuseries with them called Into the Storm. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So it's called Into the Storm, and it's an 8-part docuseries that provides viewers with a lifelike look at the devastating impacts of Hurricane Florence in North Carolina. The series begins the day leading up to the storm making landfall and continues during and following the storm as we rescued animals and documented the mass farmed animal casualties that resulted from them being locked inside of the farms and left to horrifically die as the floodwaters rushed in. The first two episodes are available for viewing on YouTube. However, to get the full experience, you'll need an Oculus Go headset or something similar to watch in virtual reality.
Can you describe to our listeners what they might experience when watching these videos?
Yeah, so these experiences, such as those that are portrayed in that virtual reality experience, that's probably the closest you'll get besides actually visiting one of these facilities on your own. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with what really any size animal exploitative facility looks like, smells like, sounds like, just imagine thousands of non-human animals are crammed into these poorly ventilated windowless sheds where they spend their entire existence before being transported to slaughter. When you walk in, they're typically screaming and squealing. It's extremely loud. It's almost deafening. It haunts you. The smell of ammonia, feces, and urine literally burn your nose as you approach the facilities. Pretty much you'll always find bodies of those who died from either illness, disease, from being in these close quarters. Stress-induced cannibalism, even in herbivorous animals, you'll see cannibalism, or you might see congenital defects from just these mass breeding operations. They have such a high rate of mortality that they typically have what's referred to as a dead pile on site, where those who died or were culled, they call it, when they kill them for various reasons, whether they weren't growing fast enough or they might have been sick. These dead piles are basically kept somewhere on site of the facility until they're picked up by a waste management company. So literally you're smelling rotting flesh and death. It's indescribable. I typically have to scrub my body and wash my clothes at least twice after entering one of these facilities. I always say after going inside that anyone who eats animal products should definitely go inside and see these places for themselves, because it is quite literally enough to make you change your lifestyle, or at least I would hope so.
When you're in these areas and you're seeing these animals floating, I was watching the video last night on YouTube. I finally found it. And you're seeing these bodies that are floating next to you. What's the thought going through your head? You obviously want to rescue these animals, but you see that there's no way to even help them at all. What's your next thought process on what you can do?
Right. So in that instance, what she's referring to is a scene out of this docuseries, Into the Storm, where one of the hundreds of chicken sheds that had been inundated by floodwaters, it actually had reached over the roof, so completely encompassing these facilities. And some of them had actually pushed the doors open with the floodwaters. So essentially, these animals were floating out in this new river that had been created by the floodwaters. So thousands of chickens and other animals were pouring out, and we were boating through, and, you know, you go in there with the hope that you can rescue somebody. And when we were boating by these facilities, it was just so ominous. It was so quiet to the point where it was eerie. You just knew that there were no survivors. So as much as we searched and we had hoped to find any survivors, there was little you could do, as you saw from the video. We were able to rescue a lot of cats and dogs that had either run up into trees or on top of housing facilities, but there were very few survivors from chickens and turkeys. There were some pigs that had gotten out and some cows that made it to higher ground, but unfortunately, there's not much you can do there except for documenting and trying to change the laws so that they can't do what they did, which was lock these animals inside, change the environmental protection ordinances, which there are some groups that are trying to do that. But documenting this is one of the best things that you can do, because you can hopefully hold people accountable with that.
For anyone just joining us, this is Voices for the Animals, and we're speaking with Elizabeth Jones discussing her recent experiences on the front lines of disaster relief during the most recent hurricanes in the Bahamas and North Carolina. Liz was just describing what she was seeing as she was on the boat. Liz, as far as these factory farms go, you said that we need a document so that we can show people and we can change the laws surrounding them. Is there anything that looks to be changing soon since we are experiencing more hurricanes and floods and natural disasters?
Unfortunately, with these industries, they're incredibly powerful and have basically limitless funds. And especially in conservative states like North Carolina, where we were during this storm, they have a lot of influence politically to basically not create more effective measures to protect animals or the environment, but in turn to protect themselves and what they deem as their assets or losses. So one of the biggest things we saw that changed from Hurricane Floyd that hit in 1999, I believe, in North Carolina, and they saw similar flooding, they at that point did not know that they should basically contain the animals. And from a PR perspective, following that, they got a lot of heat from media and the public because a lot of these animals had escaped these facilities, the chicken farms, the turkey farms, the pig facilities, and were captured on top of roofs, on top of buildings, rushing out into the public spaces. And so from that, they kind of had what I've been told meetings with the pork board and other large corporate interest groups. And they didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out. So unfortunately, so far, we haven't seen any progressive moves in the right direction. However, I do know there's environmental groups like Waterkeeper and North Carolina who were taking ground and water samples following the storm and documented the mass fish kills that followed that from a lot of these contaminants from these factory farms. And hopefully they can get some progressive changes, at least in terms of environmental protection. But in ag gag states like North Carolina, it's going to be really tough to change some of these laws.
So these farmers know that the hurricanes are coming and they intentionally lock these animals in these facilities.
Yes, exactly. And we saw that at every farm that we went to.
And what happens after they lose all of their animals? Do they get more animals? Are they funded by anybody to get more animals into those factory farms?
That's a great question. We actually were able to speak with a couple of local farmers while we were there, and they were very honest with us. And basically, a lot of the counties that were most affected there are in very low-lying areas that are prone to flooding. And with these intensified storm events from climate change and all these outside factors, they have experienced this before, something similar, and they rebuild, they have insurance policies. They essentially, one of the reasons that they lock these animals inside is because the insurance will only give them a payout if they can actually document each individual loss of life, and then they can claim that as a loss in their insurance policy. So these facilities are highly insured. They do require massive amounts of money to rebuild them and restock, as they would say, but they do it. And some of the farmers that we spoke to had already experienced this a couple times, and they don't know anything else. So this is what they continue to do.
Were you able to speak with any of the locals in those areas to see what they think about what's happening with the farms and the hurricanes? Because it's essentially ruining their water supply as well.
Unfortunately, in Duplin County, which is the region where we were based, that is one of the highest concentrations of animal agriculture in the country. This entire region is very pro-animal agriculture. They're very anti-animal activism or welfare. So we didn't actually come across anybody that spoke, in a negative context about these industries. They were more concerned with their loss of finances and their personal losses.
So we know that the meat, dairy, and egg industries are impacting climate change and natural disasters. Do you think that we've maybe gone too far to change the pace of the destruction?
I would like to say that I'm more hopeful than I am, but as climate change continues at an unprecedented rate, and these natural events are becoming more frequent and severe, I unfortunately am a little less hopeful these days. I don't think that we're seeing progressive enough change, especially when these industries that are so, they're driving the climate change and biodiversity loss, they are actually growing. While plant-based options and maybe the vegan population may be growing, unfortunately, we are also seeing a growth in animal flesh production, consumption, and a lot of this is due to a growing middle class in large countries like India and China. And with the rate that they contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, providing over 18% more than all combined exhaust from forms of transportation combined, and all of the impacts that come with that, I personally don't see us tackling the issue in time. We're at a pivotal point now, and the change needed to be made about 10 years ago. And I don't think that we're moving quickly enough, unfortunately. The scale, I don't think most people understand, because most of us are, these facilities are out of sight, out of mind. And that goes for a lot of these destructive industries like oil and gas and logging and anything that wreaks havoc on the natural world. But animal systems make up 83% of global farmland. That's a huge percentage of global farmland. But they only provide 18% of total calories and 37% of total protein. So these systems that are actually the most efficient food systems ever created, based on the sheer volume they're able to produce from these facilities, they are still very inefficient. The feed conversion ratios, which is the amount of feed crops invested into an animal to the yield of edible flesh, is very low. Chickens are the most, let's say, efficient, quote unquote, source of animal protein, and it takes 9 calories invested into one chicken to yield just 1 calorie of edible flesh. So that's an 800% food waste conversion ratio. That can never be done more sustainably. And these are highly advanced systems, and with the current rate of consumption, we're just not going to get there. And we're going to continue to see these intense storms and these giant events that are just impacting so many people, especially very vulnerable developing nations and people that don't have the resources to combat these changes. And it's really unfortunate to see.
Since you are seeing all these things happening personally, is there anything that you can suggest to anybody who might want to prepare for these natural disasters and any efforts that they can do to help animals in these disaster situations?
Absolutely. In terms of just personal preparation, I always suggest having kind of like a hurricane kit. Always have some non-perishable food and water at home for both you and any companions that might be in the home. Any life-saving medications that you may rely on, make sure you have some in case you need to flee or seek cover. Battery-powered devices and a first aid kit. Make sure you have enough fuel to escape, have an evacuation route. A lot of times people underestimate the power of some of these events and they end up getting stuck, and then even rescue personnel are unable to get to them. So that's something that I've seen firsthand, and it's devastating. So please be prepared. There's some great resources online that have comprehensive disaster plans and a list of essentials. Also, another huge thing that I always run into doing these rescue missions, a lot of shelters, unfortunately, do not allow non-human animals to come inside and seek shelter. So make sure you have a list ahead of time with animal-friendly shelters in your area, or a friend or family member that you can stay with that's in a safer zone. And if you're interested in getting more involved in disaster relief and animal rescue, I suggest getting some local experience with rescue firsthand to get more comfortable handling animals and dealing with high stress environments. And then take advantage of some of these free online training resources available through larger organizations like FEMA, Red Cross, and the ASPCA.
That's amazing that there's so many resources out there for people that they can go online and search for list of shelters for they themselves and
Absolutely.
Their non-human animals.
Yes, it's super helpful, and I definitely encourage people to take advantage of that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, Liz, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really am privileged to be able to speak to you and, you know, bring some of these issues to light.
Well, what would you say to anybody who might argue that eating meat maybe less frequently would help the problems that we're having right now?
You know, that is the reducitarian view. I know I've heard it a lot, and there's no need to consume these products. And it comes at such an expense that I don't believe that there's any way to justify it. The ethical concerns associated with it, the environmental as well as the health, there's no reason to continue using them and exploiting the animals this way. So I personally, you know, completely disagree with that state of mind. I think some people use that as a way to get to being fully plant-based, but surely if the world consumed less animal products, it would be better for the planet. But it's just not an aggressive enough approach, especially right now in the way that we're seeing the world change so quickly for the worse.
One thing that I came across recently was about the Swiss public and that they're actually trying to ban factory farming. Do you think that that's something that might be successful, at least over there, since they are agreeing that, you know, animals feel pain and suffering?
I'm not too familiar with that, but I would be skeptical just because that could result in a lot more small scale. It could just replace it, and ultimately the same number of animals would still be killed and the same amount of manure and feces would be produced. Or they could start importing the products instead, which, you know, ultimately is creating the problem just somewhere else. They're just outsourcing the issue. So it'd be interesting to see that as a case study and see how it works. But I don't know. I'm always skeptical, though.
Yeah, that's fair. For any of our listeners who are interested in seeing more of Ethically Elizabeth, where can they find you?
I am on Instagram, ethically_Elizabeth. You can visit me on Facebook at Liz Jones, or Ethically Elizabeth is my page on there. And hopefully soon I will have my website launched, and I'll have more information about that on my social media pages.
We're going to continue our conversation, which you can listen to on our extended podcast on Google Play, iTunes, or on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals. All right, Liz, sorry, I get a little bit tongue-tied.
Oh, no, that's okay. I do, too. It always depends on the day. Sometimes my brain has lots of brain farts. I totally understand. I think you were perfectly fine.
That's where I jump in, and we do some editing and make everyone sound real smart.
It's also 9 o'clock in the morning, so.
Oh, yeah, you guys, I've got a head start on you. It's a little late here. I've had more coffee than you probably have.
Yeah, you're on the East Coast somewhere, right?
Yeah, I'm in South Florida.
Mm. Yeah, some of the things you said in that interview really struck me, especially that statistic about 83% of all the farmland we use goes towards creating animal products, but we only get 18% of our calories from animal products. Was that right?
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable when you hear this, isn't it?
Yeah, it's staggering, especially when you realize that we don't need any animal products to live long, healthy, and happy lives.
Right? I know, it's especially when you just see the scale of it all and the food waste also that we don't usually consider, so much of that doesn't even end up being eaten.
Do you think that, like so many of us think, that we really have a population problem, as in too many humans, or do you think that we just have more of a resource allocation problem?
I think it's a bit of both. I personally believe that there are a lot of humans on the planet, and it's more of the consumption rate. We all are just consuming so much. And, you know, as we continue to increase the human population, we're going to just continue consuming these resources at such a rate that there's no way we can live in unison with the other animals that inhabit the world, or in a way that's environmentally friendly. But definitely, just in general, we, you know, are over-consuming and consuming the wrong things and not doing it efficiently.
Do you think that the most power the average person has over their environmental impact is in their dietary choices? Or what other ways can they affect their environmental impact?
I do believe that is a huge way to, you know, your personal impacts on the planet by reducing or eliminating your use of animals, both in your diet and in your lifestyle. Also, having fewer or not having children, you're not contributing to the population growth issue, which ultimately results in less waste and less consumption. Mm-hmm. And also just the way that you consume, whether you purchase secondhand clothing, you buy produce locally, a lot of these things can have a big effect, a big impact in the grand scale of things. So it's just about being more conscious in every facet of life, not just in what we eat.
So I have a more personal question now, if you don't mind,
sure.
Which is, like, when you were younger, when you were a kid, did you imagine yourself adventuring around the world rescuing animals from natural disasters?
I don't know about from natural disasters, but I always kind of thought I would hopefully be working with animals in some sort of capacity similar to that. I always loved The Wild Thornberrys. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that show.
I am familiar with it.
Yeah,
I'm not.
Character could speak to animals, and I feel like I always had this connection to non-humans, and I always wanted to work with them. I just didn't know in what capacity I would be able to do that, or how I, as one person, could actually make a difference.
What age were you when you made the connection between your personal consumer choices and the effect on animals?
I first started eliminating animals from my diet and lifestyle when I was 17. I started really making the connection between my food and how that affects the world around me and the animals. It took a bit to get to being fully vegan. I kind of did this slow transition where the more I learned, the more I eliminated. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago, I went fully vegan and really understand the ethics with eating and consuming animals. And I've never looked back since then. The greatest thing I personally feel that I can do. And it's a wonderful lifestyle. I feel like it brings a lot of purpose and clarity, and it's just informative in every way. You learn so much throughout this process of becoming more conscious of the world around you.
Absolutely. But I'm sure there's one question echoing through our listeners' minds, which is, where do you get your protein?
So easy. I always tell people, it's funny, I was at this new gym the other day, and oddly enough, a couple really big guys came up to my partner, and they saw his shirt, and they were talking about how they were vegetarian or vegan, and the one guy was like, well, I could never be fully vegan because, you know, the protein, and he's like, no, like, you can totally get enough protein, and I was trying to explain to him, as long as you get enough calories, it's not an issue of getting enough protein. You're going to, even if you ate 2,000 or 2,500 calories worth of potatoes, you're going to get enough protein. But this obsession with protein is just, it's not only super unhealthy for us, but obviously it comes at a huge expense to animal lives and the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there certainly is a balance to be struck. It's not always more protein is better.
Right, exactly.
But the paleo diet is really, really, really popular right now. I keep seeing posts, for whatever reason, on my Facebook of friends that are going paleo and all they want to do is consume meat protein. And I really don't know exactly what to say to them to get them to understand that that's not a necessity.
I feel like just with all of these diet crazes, it's people mostly just aren't informed. They don't have that background in nutrition or the education about proper diet and nutrition. And that's something that our education system has been failing with. You know, we are not taught a cornerstone in nutrition or in dietetics. And I think that we need to start at the root and really teach people when they're younger and, you know, and more compassionate and don't have all of these out kind of swaying them one way or the other. And bringing that to light so that people can make more informed decisions. Because ultimately, it's hurting them, and it's hurting the planet, and obviously hurting the animals.
So I, like you, consider myself an optimist. I like to look at the glasses half full. I like to have hope. So if there is a path forward for the human race where we are able to preserve our environment and halt the rapid onset of climate destruction, what do we need to do? What steps do we need to take?
That's a great question. So first and foremost, we need to take a look at each, we all need to take a look at our lives and see how we can improve, because a lot of us like to think that we are perfect or close to it. And there's always ways that we can improve, whether it's being traveling more efficiently, at home, some of the practices that we participate in. I think that one, trying to purchase in season locally produced fruits and vegetables and products is always great. Using your own containers, reducing single-use waste from your life. We can also, like I said earlier, not having as many children or choosing to adopt. So many people on the planet that are consuming so many resources. We can also compost. That's something that I don't think I see enough of. Maybe you guys out there in the West Coast is a bit more progressive in terms of that, but here it's really tough. But I've always, you know, for the last 5+ years lived in an apartment setting, and I still collect my compost and take it somewhere locally. So there's always options. There's always more sustainable sources of food and local farmers that we can support. So it's just making these conscious changes throughout so many different facets of our life, consuming less in general, especially things like clothing, that the fashion industry is so detrimental to the environment, water pollution, air pollution. It's very toxic to the people that are producing our garments. So, you know, refraining from purchasing from fast fashion and choosing more sustainable alternatives. There's so many things that we can do as individuals that can actually make a large difference. And if we all adopt some of these principles and practices, overall, it can make a huge impact on the world around us.
That's a hopeful message. Thank you for sharing that with us. And there is power that each of us have in our daily choices. And we can't change the world by ourselves, but together we do have power.
That's true. And I always tell people, too, in terms of like an activism scale, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Everybody's good at something. And just focus on something. If you're a strong writer, maybe do some local pieces in your paper on animal agriculture or the ethics of eating animals. You can write a blog, or if you're a lawyer, you could do pro bono work for an animal rights organization. There's so many things that each of us can provide to the community and services that are unique to each of our skill sets. So lending those to organizations or to your community is extremely helpful and can be very impactful.
You mentioned China and India earlier, and of course, what we do as a people in our countries, it doesn't just affect our own nations, because we're all living on the same planet, the same world. And so the environmental impact that we have, it spreads around to the nations around us. And many, as you mentioned, in the Bahamas, without the same infrastructure that we have, are more severely impacted by the climate destruction than the countries who are contributing most toward that destruction. But in China and India, there's more than 1 billion people in each country. And as they're becoming more developed, people want a more westernized lifestyle with more amenities, maybe more meat, more animal products, more possessions. Do you see in those nations environmental efforts having success?
That's a really great question. I think that China has taken some initiative to, at least in terms of more sustainable energy sources, they are leading the way in terms of that. And, you know, they are producing a lot of these products that we are consuming. So it's not even that, even though they have such a large population, we are taking from them and destroying their environment. And now they're seeing this opportunity to grow and develop. And who are we to come in and say, oh, no, you can't do that now. We've messed everything up. And now you guys have to be leading the charge. I think that helping lead the way in terms of more sustainable initiatives is incredibly important as a more powerful developed nation, and working with them on an international scale to also adopt these principles and practices, because this is something that needs to be happening on a large scale. As much as we can do as an individual, these things have to come from the top down to really have the significant change that we want to see, and that's required to really reverse the climate change direction that we're going in.
Are there any standout rescues that you can tell us about?
I would say one of the more recent ones that's near and dear to my heart is Alvin, a little three-legged kitten that we brought over from the Bahamas. We had found him in one of the local shelters we were working with, and he had unfortunately sustained a pretty severe leg injury at some point when he was younger, and was just, you know, he was the most happy, upbeat guy, but really struggling to get around and wasn't getting the attention that he needed. So we actually brought him over on a flight and got him the medical treatment and the surgery that he needed. And now he's living such an amazing life in St. Petersburg, Florida. And he's got 4 chicken sisters. He's got 4 cat brothers and sisters and a dog that he's absolutely best friends with. So that was one of the more recent ones that was really uplifting and great, you know, to come out of such a sad and devastated area. It was great to see that happy ending for him.
Do you end up adopting many of your rescues yourself? I know you're probably full up at the moment.
That used to be a problem until I learned my lesson. I actually do have 7 resident cats that we've accumulated over the years, but I've definitely put my foot down. There's been many that I've absolutely fallen in love with. But I try to, you know, find wonderful homes for them, and I keep in contact with a lot of the adopters, so that's a great part of it. But another really amazing story that just came to mind was during that hurricane in 2017 in North Carolina, while we were boating around, you know, and close by to where those chickens that you saw were all floating around, we had been searching this one area that probably had between 15 to 20 feet of water, so literally in boats. Going around, we're on the top of houses, and we kind of had given up for the day. It was about 5 o'clock. The sun was about to start setting, and I was like, you know what? I have this weird feeling, and our boat, myself and Dan Fung from Condition One, we went back around, and I found this little, about 3-week-old kitten who was literally holding on to a piece of plywood, completely drenched, looked like a little wet rat, and she was crying for help, and we were able to get her, and Dan Fung and his partner actually ended up adopting her after she got a bit bigger and stronger, and she was actually flown out to them in Utah. And that's just an amazing story. If you guys are interested, you can check out her before and after picture on Condition One's social media page, and that was just such a heartwarming story that came out of that.
Oh, what a story. Yeah, it can be easy sometimes when you're divorced from the reality of these situations just to think of these animals in terms of numbers and statistics and how much difference are we really making rescuing one animal at a time when there's such widespread devastation. But then you realize from a story like that that it might just be one life, but to that one life, it's everything.
Exactly. And that's the mentality that I always have going into these things. You know, they value their lives just as much as any of us do. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing and, you know, heartwarming to see these positive endings for even if it's just a couple of them. But to go through some of the things that they have and experience these disasters and come out of it and have wonderful lives afterwards is so worth it.
Well, I think we're coming towards the end, Elizabeth, but I was supposed to bring up Noah's gloves, jokingly. We actually met you last year at the ALWC. I'm not sure if you remember, but Noah let you borrow his gloves, and he was wondering where they're at.
Oh, my gosh. I do have your gloves.
Oh, you still have them.
I actually just found them the other day, actually. I just moved from Miami to Fort Lauderdale, and I had them in my winter jacket, which I don't ever need to wear down here.
Yeah.
So the next time I see you guys, I'll bring the gloves.
Well, I think they're about $2 gloves, but I'll hold you to that. Will we see you at the Animal Liberation Conference next year?
The glove thief. Perhaps. I always am, you know, I never commit to things too far in advance because I never know where I'm going to be, but I would be really great to see you guys again and give you your gloves back.
I look forward to it. We really appreciate you coming on to the show, Liz. You have so much to share, and we wish you all the best.
All righty. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you. You too. Have a good one.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.